Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcast. You'll be glad you did.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
All right, the Astros are a mess. They're 4-10. Three out of four games this week, they basically just had one inning implode on them, and that was curtains in each of those games, and yesterday was the worst one yet. Hunter Brown, 9 runs, 2/3 of an inning, and they lose to the Royals 13-3. Back home for the Rangers this weekend, and we'll see what happens from there. Reggie Jackson was on John Heyman's podcast. John Heyman, longtime baseball writer. And Reggie Jackson, I don't know what his title is. He's an advisor to Jim Crane. I know that.
He's one of the many people that orbit Jim Crane who don't necessarily have an official duty. They're just there for advice and expertise in any way that maybe Jim Crane sees fit, just like Bagwell and Biggio.
Yeah. And in fact, Reggie Jackson actually laid that out. John Heyman asked him about some of the moves that they've made, moves they didn't make, moves they might make, and Reggie Jackson first laid out how the whole decision-making process works with the leadership team.
We have a great leadership group in our with our GM. Also, we have a couple of other advisors in Craig Biggio and Jeff Bagwell, who are very much involved in our decision-making. I'm involved. Jim takes those decisions and puts them together, listens to our management and coaching staff on the field, talks to our GM and his staff, and then, of course, some of the analytics come into the future of a player, and our decisions are made that way, along with being fiscally responsible.
Okay, so that's the structure, loosely. Like how he dropped analytics in there. felt a little like he was checking a box to me. Jeff Luna, honestly, if they asked Jeff Luna about it back in the day, he probably wouldn't even mention analytics. You know what I mean?
Wonder,
it's just baked into the whole thing.
Well, every team has a bunch of quants down there in their basement doing whatever they do.
Like Reggie was doing a solid for the analytics people right there.
Feel like it's wonder, and I think what people worry about sometimes is, all right, how much weight? Like, he just mentioned people that had roles in the organization, but like, what's the weighted percentage for each of those guys?
Yeah.
Like, is there an entire department of either analytics people or baseball scouts or anything who only count for like 15% of what Jim Crane listens to compared to maybe Bagwell at 38%?
Yeah.
I think that's what makes people nervous.
Yeah. So that's the leadership handle. And that 30 seconds paints a picture to me. I'm going to get to this other bit of audio here before give our overall assessment on this and why I'm nervous about this. It definitely has a feel of a lot of cooks in the kitchen. Too many, maybe? A lot of cooks in the kitchen. And no mention of Dana Brown by name, just mention of the GM. Here was a specific thing from Reggie Jackson. The Blake Snell decision. The decision that the price of poker got too high for them to acquire Blake Snell.
Being fiscally responsible, I think, is what kicked us out of the Snell deal. He signed a 2-year deal, I want to say, for 62. That's too much for him. He's been hurt a couple of times. And I think there's incentives on top of that. He's also got an option on his own, and between the four or five people that make the decisions with the Astros, we don't play that game.
Yeah, I hear the four or five people making decisions for the Astros. This terrifies me. I'll be honest with you. This terrifies me that you've got three old school guys in the room with the owner. The owner who has the right to do whatever he wants. I will concede that. It's his team. He can do what he wants. So I'm not even going to pull Jim Crane and his decisions and what he likes or doesn't like. He's gotten some wrong for sure, but whatever. He's been a great owner for the last 7 years. Dana Brown, the GM, I can't listen to those two bits of audio, Seth, and even get mad at Dana Brown for things that are going bad with the team. And I don't know if I can get mad at him moving forward. I don't know how much of these decisions are even being made by Dana Brown right now.
I was on one of the national broadcasts, because remember there were like 19 national broadcasts in the first five games. In one of the national broadcasts, one of the commentators had just kind of casually mentioned that Jim Crane was maybe in the top five in the league when it came to owner involvement in negotiations and things like that. And that's always, I think that can sometimes be a good thing, but I think usually it scares people when it's weird, but sometimes the GM is the guy who best protects the owner from himself.
Yes.
You know, like, and good GMs take that responsibility. Like, they're like, okay, you know, the good GM tries to be a traffic cop for anybody that might get too impatient or might get too impulsive at any given moment, including the owner. Because a lot of GMs feel like, okay, it's kind of like if you're an accountant for a rock star. You're like, all right, I got to be sure that this guy, you know, doesn't go, like, too widely out of orbit on this tour. Like, yeah, he wants to have four tour buses, and he just flat out, it's a waste of money. I know he's the boss, but I got to try to convince him that he doesn't need four tour buses.
Yeah.
That's Jim Crane, rock star.
Rock star.
Jim. But kind of in that, like, kind of scary part of the rockumentary where they've had some success. They start messing around with, all of a sudden they got all these people on tour that don't need to be there, and it gets kind of scary.
Yeah, if we're categorizing owners here, Jim Crane, yeah, very involved. At least he's involved and willing to invest, so I will say that. Like, when you have owners cheap and involved, it gets really bad.
Yeah, I know. I see people calling Jim Crane cheap. You got to realize that they're spending above their weight limit this year in terms of market size compared to they're in the top three in salary. They're not a top three revenue-producing team.
To be clear,
he's not cheap.
Yeah, no, he's not. He's absolutely not. And to be clear, the audio I played there is way less about the decision to get out on Blake Snell. I mean, they sure could use Blake Snell right now because the starting rotation is injured and the guys who are there other than Ronel Blanco and kind of Christian Javier has been bad. So, yeah, like, the look is bad that you're 4-10 and Blake Snell might have been a big help. I have no idea how Snell's doing for the Giants, admittedly. Haven't followed. Got too many problems here with the Astros. The whole four or five guy, you know, you got the Dave Clark five here doing the decision making here. You know, it's a committee of five, including the owner, making these decisions. I just look back at the heyday for the Astros, you know, early in this dynasty. And I can't imagine Jeff Luhnow operating in an environment where he's got to take input from Craig Biggio, Jeff Bagwell, and Reggie Jackson. And they are considered voting members in these decisions. You know what
in
I mean?
Terms of, like, yeah, the things that made, like, okay, what made you the team that you are? A lot of it was a culture of defying conventional wisdom, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where I think there's always got to be a balance there. You always got to, you know, you don't want to get to the Jack Easterby part where you think that defying conventional wisdom is the only thing that matters. Right. And that as long as you're defying conventional wisdom, then you're thinking outside the box and everything is awesome. You don't want to go that far, obviously. But you also, I don't think you want to, when what made you great was bucking trends, doing things differently than everybody else had done them for generations. I think that, yeah, relying on more and more people that, like, not just chafe against analytics, but are very much rooted in doing things the old school way. You've strayed from the core of what made you what you are, you know?
Yeah, in a big way. I mean, it's not just one voice you've got there. Craig Biggio, Jeff Bagwell, Reggie Jackson, all of whom Hall of Fame players, tremendous players. And you know, like that they're part of the organization, cool, but that it feels like this five-man committee making decisions.
Honestly, there could be no better metaphor for it than the often used phrase, just turn over the back of the baseball card. Look at the back of a Braves baseball card, where you see what? Oh, yeah, a whole bunch of conventional stats and a whole bunch of gumption and got to, and here we go. Like, it's just, yeah, that's... I've got a room full of nerds with advanced degrees, or look at the back of the baseball card.
Yeah.
Have you considered this? I want any of these guys to show up in court as expert witnesses in a murder trial and be like, well, have you considered this? And out of the back, they pull O.J. Simpson's rookie card. They're like, have you considered this, Your Honor? Have you considered this?
Right.
Yeah. Just look at him. Look at him run in the snow.
So this terrifies me. I'm just going to say it right now. Those two bits of audio from Reggie Jackson, I think this team, this version of the Astros this year, can pull this thing out of the nosedive and be a playoff team. I do. They're going to get guys back. Yeah. It's not, you know, the hitting is going to come through at some point. I don't know that they're winning 95 games this year or anything like that, but they've got too many good players to be, you know, 4-10 proportionally all year long. This scares me more about the future. The same way I was scared yesterday, Seth, about the fact that we're in this triage situation now where guys are getting hurt, this and that, and there's no solutions anywhere. We have a horrible first base situation. There's no solution anywhere in the system. We have pitching issues. There are no solutions anywhere in the system. We're running out of answers. This is the group that's supposed to find those answers, and I don't feel good about it at all.
I know the people that come at you that you get frustrated with are the ones that will say, you know, hey, it's not my money. You know, when you believe that a deal was bad or what have you, like you're criticizing the Abreu deal, and people say, well, like, well, it's not your money. He can do whatever he wants with it. No. It's very much the team's money, and they can do whatever they want with it. But like the reason people will make accusations of an owner being cheap in this instance, it's not that he's not spending money. It's that he's spending way too much money on stuff that's not helping out at all. So yeah, he has to be cheap with like a Blake Snell. Oh, $30 million a year on a short-term contract is too much for Blake Snell. My ass, it's too cheap. You don't have the money to spend on it because you spent money on Abreu.
Yep.
Like that's why it's too expensive for you.
Yep.
It's not that Blake Snell's contract got too expensive. It's that the money isn't being spent appropriately elsewhere.
Text message. We get a lot of texts on Joe Espada. Text message. Not a Joe Espada fan. He sounds so lame. Text message. I'm out on Joe and Dana. Text message. The dynasty is dying. This is a challenge. I think this is going to be. This might be. Perceptually in this town, one of the biggest challenges Joe Espada is going to have, that his predecessors, both Dusty Baker and to a lesser extent, A.J. Hinch didn't have.
Yeah.
The advantage that those two had over Joe Espada. Joe Espada is going to be operating here for now and in the near future in a city where the other two head coaches are immensely popular. And they're dogs. They are guys with big personalities that you can get behind in Ime Udoka and D'Amico Ryans. And, yeah, you hear a Joe Espada cut, and Joe seems like a really – I don't know him at all, but he seems like a really nice guy. I don't know how good a manager he is. His team stinks right now. But he seems like a guy. At 4-10, Ime Udoka, I think, would still be rallying the troops. At 4-10, D'Amico Ryans, I think there would still be a belief. And here's the thing. Both those teams are going to be good for a while. And we don't know what the Astros are going to be. And Joe Espada is operating in this environment where Dusty Baker had the advantage of not only managing a good team, but when you're looking around the city on the aggregate, on the macro, Seth, and it's Steven Silas and David Culley and Lovey Smith, and during A.J. Hinch, it's kind of docile Mike D'Antoni and Bill O'Brien, who everybody hated towards the end. This is going to be a tricky environment city-wise for Joe Espada to exist in with Ime and with D'Amico.
People aren't going to be placated by a soft-spoken head coach in a time of strife like this. This is not the time to bring Mr. Rogers in, and Espada feels a little bit like you're There's a fire down the street. Who should we call? Get Mr. Rogers on it. He'll be like, yeah, get him on the bucket brigade. That's right. And like, no, nobody's saying that. That's like, you need an ass kid. You need somebody who's going to kick butt, right? And Espada is very much of a, comes in wearing a cardigan and let's talk about your feelings type of guy. David Culley, for instance, it was not going to wear well with a guy with Culley. I mean, there was more than just his soft-spoken persona and demeanor. Yeah, it was a lot more than that.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to pin a bunch of this on Espada. It's just the problem is the actual real problems so far have been very – they've been things that Espada was not going to fix. Espada wasn't all of a sudden turn Blair Henley into an awesome pitcher. And they won that game. Espada, I don't think Espada is all of a sudden responsible for Hunter Brown, maybe just not being a good major league pitcher. Like, all of these things are systemic things. The problems with the relief, the problems with the pitching staff and whole, the starting pitchers' injuries, all of that stuff. That stuff that was there last year with Dusty, it's here this year with Espada. I always felt like Dusty did a lot of stuff that deserved criticism, but it got to a toxic point where everybody wanted to blame everything on Dusty. And I think people are starting to advance to that. Some people are starting to advance to that spot with Espada super fast.
Yeah. These texts are really interesting. I'm a month away from saying trade Bregman, Tucker, Presley, and retool for a year or two from now.
Yeah, like right. I mean, yeah, that's extreme. I'm just trying to think, like, okay, that compared to what should Espada have done right now to get them out of this? Like, what – and I'm honestly asking, like, what should have Espada done in the first – what's the record now?
Four and ten.
To start out 4-10 to where they'd actually have a winning record right now.
Yeah. It's a good question. I don't have an answer.
I mean, I'm genuinely asking. What would make you feel – everything that would have needed to happen for this team to be good, how much control did Espada have over any of those things?
Yeah, yeah. Normally I'd say he's playing Abreu too much, but they have no solution behind Abreu right now. You know, like
right.
and he's made some curious in-game decisions, but that's not losing, they're not 4-10 because of that.
Pinch hitting Singleton, all right? You know, like that would be one of those things, but part of that is like, all right, well, they also, Singleton's the guy they have. Inserting Singleton over Dubon or what have you, those are things that maybe could have salvaged a game or two.
Yeah.
But when so much of the issue is the pitching in general and the health of the pitching, it's just hard to say. Yeah, he's made curious decisions, but given, like, last year, we were upset with Dusty because he wasn't playing Yiner Diaz more.
Yep.
This year, I think I'm cool with the way the catchers are being deployed. I can't possibly be mad that they're not playing John Singleton more than Abreu.
Right.
You know, they're just, I don't know what you're going to do.
Dude, how far would Yiner's home run yesterday have gone if there was no wind? He hit that thing. I mean, it made the score 9-1, so it's kind of lost in the shuffle. But when he hit that, and we saw what the wind was doing the first few innings of that game, I'm like, that thing landed beyond, like, at the top of the bleachers in left field. That thing would have gone like 500 feet if there were no wind. That was crazy. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. All right, good question to the Utopia mailbag about the Texans. You have to pick one Texan, player, coach, exec, whatever, to win a major award for the 2024 season. I've got a list of these. Who is it for you? I'll run that by Seth as well. That's coming up next.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. you've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
Payne and Pendergast with you. So, good question from a listener to the Utopia Football Podcast on the in the mailbag. believe it was from Michael, if I'm not mistaken.
Good job, Michael.
Way to go, Michael. You got to pick one Texan player, coach, or executive to win a major award for the upcoming season. Who would it be? And I think there's really, I think there's four distinct possibilities. I'll say this, you know, maybe they draft somebody who gets in on the rookie of the year conversation. I think the fact that A, this roster probably doesn't have a whole lot of room for rookies to make a huge impact this year, which feels good, right? I mean,
right,
it's a plus they're not picking as of right now until 42. So by definition, they're going to be drafting rookies that probably have a diminished chance of winning rookie of the year. Although Puka almost won it last year. He was a fifth round pick, so who knows? But I think there's four possibilities here that, fit this question. See, the obvious one is C.J. Stroud winning the MVP of the league. He's 9-1 right now. He's tied for third on the odds board behind Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen, ironically, and then he's tied with Joe Burrow for third.
That's the Josh Allen one is interesting. I think it just mostly, I'm guessing, the perception that if the Bills are going to be good, it's going to be off of Josh Allen doing some heroic things. And especially perhaps a rookie or two wide receivers.
Yeah, that's a great point, Seth. That has more to do with the if the Bills are good, what it's going to look like, than the likelihood that the Bills are going to be good. You know what I mean? Like that's because I don't think it's likely CJ, they're going to be that great. But if they are, it's Josh Allen. You know,
CJ is going to have to fight against a little bit, not as much, but a little bit of the narrative out in San Francisco, which is, you know, Brock Purdy. Well, look, he's got Brandon Ayuk and Debo Samuel and Christian McCaffrey and George Kittle. That's an embarrassment of riches. Of course, anybody could be a good quarterback there. CJ doesn't have as much of that, but I think people will point to the three wide receivers. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I agree with it, everybody, just to put down your weapons. But people are going to say, or voters will say, well, look, he's got those three wide receivers. I mean, it's unfair compared to what Josh Allen was working with.
Yeah, I think if the Texans win 12 games, I think CJ's got a great shot at it. I think that's the barometer. Because if they win 12 games, they're probably winning the division, and they're in the conversation for number one overall seed. I think that might get him there.
Who was the number one?
Mahomes. Patrick Mahomes. Mahomes.
I don't know. Mahomes at this point has a little bit of the LeBron thing going, doesn't he? Where it's like you got to outdo your best, really, to get acknowledgement as the MVP.
Maybe.
You know, and last year he wasn't an MVP performer at all, not even close to it. But his heroics were in the postseason.
Yeah. That's
I wouldn't put Mahomes at the top if I were a handicapping man.
He might be at that stage where voters, they're bored voting for him for MVP. That's what it got with LeBron. It got that way with Michael Jordan. And I don't feel any shame at all comparing Patrick Mahomes to either of those guys. He's the Michael Jordan of this league. D'Amico Ryan's coach of the year. This is a tricky one because D'Amico, typically you win coach of the year by doing one of two things. And there are exceptions, but generally speaking, you are either a first-year head coach who does what D'Amico did last year, which is take an awful team and turn them into a good team. Against all odds, or you're an established coach whose team is one of the one or two or at worst three best teams in football. You know, you're winning 14, 13 games, something like that. D'Amico obviously has already, you know, he missed the boat on the first one by one vote. He lost. He actually finished in a tie for coach of the year last year and lost in a tiebreaker. I think the Texans probably, for D'Amico, probably do need to be like the number one seed in the AFC for him to win coach of the year, I think.
Do you think the one that's weird, now Dayball, when he won it, was a rookie head coach, right? Mm-hmm. That was his first year. It was 2022. That was the one, usually you need at least 11 wins. Dayball got it going 9-7-1, which I think more than anything is a reflection on how much people hate Daniel Jones more so than anything else. Like that was a, I mean, he won Coach of the Year because people couldn't believe that Daniel Jones actually won, was going to the playoffs.
That's right.
You know, like beyond that, you got to win 11 games. It's very, very rare to get it without winning 11 games, and they technically have a tougher schedule this year. I think for DeMeco to win the Coach of the Year this year, I almost don't want it because I feel like it would mean that CJ Stroud got injured.
Oh, like Stefanski last year?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. See, that's one of the exceptions. Like Stefanski was neither of those things in 2023 that I just outlined. But
yeah.
Like that's an exceptional thing in the eyes of the voters was, man, he won games with four different starting quarterbacks.
Yeah, I think they've got enough names on offense now that even though they weren't names before DeMeco took over the team, I think they have enough names on offense now that the thing that would make DeMeco a Coach of the Year is if the defense ends up being a top three defense.
Yeah.
People look at it kind of like, well, boy, it really became DeMeco's team this year, and as good as the offense was, it was the defense that was their calling
card.
That's
a good point. Win a bunch of games and have a monster defense.
So,
I like that.
Yeah, so I think I do want DeMeco to win Coach of the Year as long as it doesn't involve a CJ Stroud. This is the one codicil. It cannot involve a CJ Stroud injury.
Okay, I like that.
I'm very specific in my wants, Sean.
Third one, Will Anderson, Defensive Player of the Year. This feels like the least likely.
That's what I want.
I want it all.
That's what I want, yeah.
Yeah.
No, you know what I don't want? I don't want that. I would love for him to have that, but if I have to choose between all of those, we've seen up close and personal three times that winning Defensive Player of the Year doesn't guarantee you an incredible football team.
Yep.
So I think that's the one that has maybe that's the one that has the least effect on just how actually we happy,
yeah.
happy we are. I feel like if CJ wins the MVP, you're almost assuredly a team that's threatening to go deep in the playoffs.
Oh, yeah.
If DeMeco wins MVP with this current squad, I think it means they're a really, really good football team. I mean, Defensive Player of the Year, that you could, they could win four games and Will Anderson could win Defensive Player of the
Year. Yeah, yeah. Last one, Nick Caserio, Executive of the Year.
I'm just pessimistic that he'll get it. I would love for him to get it. It would be nice for him, but we've seen way too often the executive of the year ends up on his butt in the street 2 years
sure.
2 years later.
For sure,
and
yes.
that everybody thinks he was the worst GM ever.
I think maybe
Ryan Grigson.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm a little more bullish on his chances of getting that. He's been, executive-wise, the star of this offseason. You know, a lot of it is first impressions, and the first impressions for executives are made in March and April. And
yeah.
So he's off to a hell of a start. I don't know that they put out odds on Executive of the Year. These other ones they put out odds on every 2 weeks, it feels like. But I think, Nick, if the Texans win the division and are like a 2 seed in the AFC, I think Nick's got a really good shot. I think he might have the second best shot of these four guys behind CJ at MVP.
Man, I'll just start off so people know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It really all started off back in 2010 with Scott Pioli. Scott Pioli was the GM of the year in 2007 for the Patriots. That worked out well for him. He got a job, but he ended up with the Chiefs. 2010 left, I don't want to say in disgrace, but in a lot of people's minds, in disgrace. Trent Baalke from the 49ers, it would be a rocky road. Ryan Grigson.
Horrible.
Just one of the most...
He's terrible.
Yeah, like one of the least respected GMs of this century, I think. He won GM of the Year in 2012. So John Dorsey of the Chiefs. That made sense, actually. But Jerry Jones won it in 2014. I don't need it. I don't respect the award.
Yeah.
I think it's a bogus award that's too much like rewarding chance things, and a lot of times the really good GMs actually don't get honored because they're doing things that are either just too boring or what have you.
Someone said,
did Ozzie Newsome ever win it?
Win Executive of the Year? I don't know. You've got the
list. I don't
think
he did.
Really?
I don't think Ozzie Newsome won it a single time.
And
That's all you need to know about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you could argue that he's been the best executive in the league in this century, you know, in the 2000s. Ravens GM, long time, for those who don't know. Someone texts in, Tank Dell, Comeback Player of the Year. I thought about Comeback Player of the Year, and this is not to minimize how quickly Tank has come back from his injury, nor the season I think he's going to have. I think Tank Dell's going to have a huge season this year. I really do. Broken leg in week 13 is typically not going to
It's not as inspirational. It's not of a the comeback,
I mean,
right?
Yeah. It's got to be like Joe Burrow, for example, probably has a better chance because he's a higher profile player who will probably lead the Bengals to 12 wins this year.
They don't even listen to the thing too. He broke his fibula, which is, as anybody will tell you, like, it doesn't even get recognized in, like, when people say to point to your shin bone. Like, no, you're pointing to your tibia. Like, people call it up. They ignore it completely when they say, oh, I hurt my shin bone.
It's barely a bone. It's like Pluto was as a planet for a while. Eventually, we just... I hear that the medical committees are about to say that... Which bone is it, Seth? The tibia
or
the
fibula?
Fibula. I hear they're about to downgrade it from bone to just... stick.
It's like a calcium deposit.
Right, a calcium. That's what they're downgrading it to. It's a calcium deposit. Yeah,
it's a floating bone. I don't even know what that is, other than like it's. What would you rather have, your fibula or your appendix?
I don't know.
Flip a coin.
I don't know. But if I was Tank Dell in my car listening right now, I would be like, "You guys want me to come up to the studio and break your fibulas? See how it feels?"
Oh no! I'm not saying it doesn't hurt.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that it's. It's not. It's not an inspirational story for a comeback, like you said. Yeah.
It'll feel
like the comeback of the year for us because we've seen the difference with him in and out of the offense. But I don't think he'll get league-wide attention.
Dude, I think Tank is going to have – if he's healthy, I think he's going to have a monster year. I don't know. This whole layers and layers of actual good players on offense as opposed to Bill O'Brien's layers and layers of players a few years ago, I think Tank might benefit the most of anybody out of all this.
I think Tank Dell – you know, Tank Dell is an interesting – in an interesting spot too, because at some point here we'll start to see, you know, around June and July when it's slow, we're going to start to see a lot of lists about like candidates for breakout player of the year, and I almost wonder if Tank is even eligible for that, because I feel like getting 709 yards in 11 games is maybe enough to just already say he's already broken out. I think in a lot of people's minds, like, well, no, he just got injured. He had already broken out, so he's already past the point of being a potential breakout player of the year.
I guess
Nico Collins likewise, right?
Yeah. Nico broke out. His breakout was last year, for sure.
So they didn't get to live through. They never actually had a genuine candidacy for breakout player of the year.
Is there an actual award for breakout player of the year, or are we just making up a
mythical? No, people write articles about it.
Oh, I got you.
They'll write articles about it during some dead time during the season or at the end of the season. Before the season, in June and July especially, that's when those articles
For sure. Someone said Aaron Rodgers comeback player of the year. He might.
Oh, yeah.
He might.
He will.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, honestly, that's where I think people will be tested on. I myself find somebody, like, I've just... Aaron Rodgers has been annoying to me since long before I found out that he was a conspiracy theorist or anything like that.
Right.
It was just the way he was handling his negotiations in Green Bay. It just reeked of Southern Belle coyness and BS like that. That put me off on him. So I don't care. I disagree with him about some things. I think he's got a point on other things. But I feel like if Aaron Rodgers comes back and plays at a really high caliber and you don't consider him as comeback player of the year, you got to have a conversation with yourself about whether you're like letting various other things affect you.
Oh, dude,
you
know? Absolutely. Like
he's in his damn 40s with a torn Achilles tendon. That used to be a death sentence for a football player.
The Florio articles, if Aaron Rodgers is having a good year, and he's up for comeback player of the year, like if he's the odd, because they put out odds on that during the season. I mean, DeMar Hamlin led all season long until the night of the award when Joe Flacco got it. So the Florio articles are going to be tremendous.
It'll honestly be a test. It'll be like you.
It will.
In Rodgers' minds, like anybody who's been vaccinated won't vote for him for MVP
dude.
Like he's on the. Don't get me wrong. Rodgers is. I find Rodgers insufferable these days. Yeah. But if he did that, I would 100% vote for him for comeback player of the year.
If he plays well, you got to, man. If he plays well, you got. If he plays well enough, if he deserves it, and you feel that way, you got to.
I say that as somebody who kind of probably people would be surprised at some of the things I kind of feel like Aaron Rodgers has a point on. I say that I still find him insufferable.
Right.
He has reached that point where like. Even when he's saying things that I agree with, I don't want him to be the one agreeing with me. It's annoying as hell.
OJ passed away yesterday, which made me immediately think of...
Who says? Aaron Rodgers?
He's
a snake person.
Immediately made me think of, where were you when... ... I think the OJ chase is the ultimate for people in a certain age group, right? What were some of the other ones? The where were you when...
Oh, yeah.
We'll get to those coming up next.
Hey everyone, Boomer Esiason here. The NFL Draft is behind us and your favorite team is now gearing up for week number one. The free Odyssey app puts you right in the middle of the pro football conversation with the biggest sports radio stations from across the country. The local voices who know your team the best, giving you their unfiltered takes on the current state of your squad. It's always football season right here on the free Odyssey app.
Live from the Twin Peaks Studios, Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
Sean Pendergast, Seth Payne with you on a Friday. We'll get to the 8 at 8 at the top of the hour. Eight stories for you. Get your day going. O.J. Simpson passes away yesterday, 75 years old. Prostate cancer was what got him. My first thought with O.J. When he passed away, My first thought was, as I said yesterday, that is one conversation with St. Peter that I would love to be a fly on the wall for. Number two, he was probably, for me, Seth, like if you were to just say the remember where you were moment for, if someone were to ask me, what's your biggest remember where you were moment for me? OJ is for sure, the OJ chase is for sure like in the top two or three. It's probably OJ and 9/11 are like the two biggest ones for me. The OJ chase and 9/11.
And I was kind of thinking from my childhood, obviously, 9/11 would be a huge one.
Yep.
Like Brandon and I were just talking about that the other day because my sister was visiting anyway. The Challenger disaster.
Mm-hmm.
The Operation Desert Storm, when we found out, like I can remember specifically when I found out that we were actually going to war.
For the first time in our lifetimes, probably.
Right. Yeah, in 1990, right?
Yep.
So, was it 91?
It was
anyway,
90. It was not yet. 90, it was summer 90. 90, yeah.
I remember, I was at a wrestling match. They announced it right before the beginning of the wrestling match. Like we were getting ready to, it was crazy because they announced it and it was right before the national anthem. And
might have been 91. Might have been early 91. You might be right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I don't remember the actual date, but I remember where I was.
So, January 16th, 1991. Yep.
Yeah. So, like that, the O.J. Simpson chase, I think most people our age definitely remember that.
For sure. Yeah.
Where they were.
Yep.
As I told you before, I was coming back from a date with my girlfriend at Red Lobster, and I was realizing at the moment, driving home, like she was complaining about me having taken her to Red Lobster, and frankly,
I was like, college kid, right?
I was like, you know what, we're about to go watch something on television. No. This is the whole thing. This is before we knew about the OJ stuff.
Yeah.
She was. I had led her to believe that we were just going to Taco Bell. Because like I was trying to surprise her. They're like, no, we're actually going to this place that's going to cost like 3 days of work for me to pay for. But she got there and she couldn't even put on a show of not being disappointed. She said, well, I'd been hoping to go to Taco Bell. Mm-hmm. That's all.
So she wanted Taco Bell. Okay.
Yeah, which I guess is a good thing in hindsight. I shouldn't have teased her. Like you teased me with a taco, honestly.
Oh.
If you get me in the mood for a taco and then offer sex as a substitute, I'd be like,
Yeah. I don't know.
I'm talking if that's you offering it to me, Sean. Oh. Obviously, if it's my wife, it might be a different story. I can't tell you how many times Sean would be like, hey, you want to go get a taco? And I'm like, yeah. And we get in the car, and like halfway there, he's like, well, you know, we could do other things too.
Happens all the time.
Yes.
We're getting people texting in. You know, it's funny.
Take off the child lock, Sean.
The O.J. chase, I think, hits different for people in Houston because of the Rockets game going on while it was happening. The first 10 texts that have come in are like, where was I? I was trying to watch the damn Rockets game.
Yep.
O.J. is getting chased down the freeway. Text message, watching the Rockets game at Carlos and Charlie's in Cancun. Bar erupted when they interrupted the game. Text message, where was I during the chase? Trying to watch the damn Rockets game, but they kept breaking into coverage of the white damn Bronco. They did split the screen, right? I mean, you could watch both.
Yeah.
And it was hard to argue. Of all the things that were going to supersede an NBA Finals game, Game 5, I believe it was, in New York, O.J. Simpson getting chased down the freeway after he was being accused of murder of his wife and her friend makes the cut, you know, no pun intended. Like it is above the line. you know,
right,
things
right,
that supersede.
Right. Yeah, that's a, yeah, the things that sometimes these crossover things are things that happen where, remember, people got upset. I can't remember which game was interrupted by the tornado warnings a couple years ago.
Oh, it was Thanksgiving. It was Thanksgiving Day. It was Thanksgiving Day, and KHOU cut in with tornado warnings, literally as Buffalo and Detroit, as the game, literally as Buffalo's driving for the game-winning field goal.
It was like Heidi, the Heidi game, except that Heidi was a vicious weather event.
It was an awesome Twitter moment, though, people freaking out over it.
And really, you know, talking to Jason Bristol about that, I can't remember who the weatherman was, but like, it was, you know.
I can see his face. I can't remember his name.
Weather people will get some kind of playful hate from people about how they're responsible for the weather or anything. But they're never plunged right into sports Twitter the way that poor dude was that day. Yeah.
Dude, yeah.
It was it's a whole different world, man.
Yeah.
Whole different world.
Yeah,
that's
why
Matt Musil was so incredible for staying as positive as he was his entire
career. And he was on social media. Like,
Matt, I know. And Matt Musil was like the most happy-go-lucky, positive vibes dude ever. And despite working in sports for decades.
I remember where I was when the O.J. Chase happened. I was I watched the O.J. Chase with Lou Holtz. I was at his daughter's rehearsal. Well, she was getting married that weekend. His daughter, yeah. Liz, who's one of my very good friends to this day, still, we're really good friends. And she was getting married that weekend. The Chase was on a Friday, so they had the rehearsal dinner that night somewhere. I wasn't part of the wedding party, so I wasn't at the rehearsal dinner. But then they had a party at a bar on campus. They rented out this bar on campus at Notre Dame for like the next wave of friends. You know, you had the wedding party, and then like the next 75 people and the wedding party all went to senior bar and partied and hung out and drank and blah, blah, blah. Well, I'm standing there because I was 24 at the time, 25, before I was married and had kids and responsibility, where my money was basically my own. So I could very easily put a $1,000 bet on the Rockets to win the NBA Finals.
Right, right.
So I was very...
You were dialed in.
I was very focused on that Rockets game. Yes, yeah. I was standing there.
You were distracted
there.
From the you're not in the moment at the party. You're very much elsewhere.
At
right?
all. Yeah. Yes, you captured that perfectly. Everybody else is having fun. I'm standing there holding
you're freaking Ipe Mitsuhara.
I was, dude. I was Ipeing this whole thing, and I'm not even Ipe sounds like was able to hide that kind of stuff. I'm standing
there.
Ipe
was going to be able to cover the bet.
That's
for a while
true too.
Yeah.
So I'm standing there holding my cup and I'm watching the Rockets game on the big screen. And you got to keep in mind, in 1994 at a bar, it wasn't like this nice flat screen. It was one of those gigantic tube projector with the red and the green and the blue light.
It was a cathode ray tube with the headlights. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this thing was beyond a piece of furniture. Like, this was a superstructure. So I'm standing there in front of this big screen watching it, holding my cup, and the screen splits. And on one half is the game, and the other half is the Chase.
Yeah.
And I'm just watching this. I was really still more intent watching the game. I'm kind of glancing at the Chase, but I hear this voice next to me. And this voice says, "This is unbelievable. This is the biggest fall from grace I've ever seen. This is incredible." And I turn, and I'm like, "Wow. Hey, Coach Holtz, how you doing?" And we stood there.
At the moment, you probably didn't. You weren't thinking about how this was going to become like one of the defining moments of a generation.
No, I did. I didn't. And you're right. My first thought wasn't, "Man, I'm going to be telling this story." Certainly didn't think I'd be telling this story on the radio 30 years from now.
Right.
But it was fun. Like, we just sat there and we chopped it up about the O.J. Chase for about 15 minutes. Here's the thing that people forget. Is that OJ was one of the sideline reporters for Notre Dame football the previous season, because NBC had that contract. You go back and watch the Notre Dame Florida State game from 1993, the game of the century. Charlie Ward and Notre Dame won that game. OJ Simpson is the sideline reporter for that game. So we were talking about how he was in the building with our teams, talking to our players just last November. He's in the building.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Was he, did he weigh in at all on whether he thought he did it or anything like
that?
At that point, we didn't really know. Like, there was very little information. All we knew, because he had to, like, there was a lot of confusion about what had happened. People had their own theories and everything, but they had just, you know, they had gone to his house to arrest him.
Yep.
They were like, "Sure, OJ, go ahead and explore the space for a little bit before we do anything." And all of a sudden, he was gone. How'd he get away? He got into his car and left. I guess that was
LAPD.
The thing, yeah.
Like some yokel backwater county. He said he needed to go to the bathroom. Said he had to take a leak. Didn't want peeing all over himself.
How did this criminal mastermind evade the authorities?
Yeah.
He said, I'm going to go grab something for my car. Have you seen my keys? Yeah.
Right. Basically, we're getting text messages. People weighing in with other things that kind of fit this category.
The defining moments of our,
the David Koresh compound burning down. I bet a lot of people in Texas probably feel that one.
Huge. I mean, that's one thing I learned about when I first got here. I remember just like, oh gosh, yeah, this is a, you know, be very sensitive in talking about that. There were a lot of people that were very involved in that from down here. Yeah.
Miracle on Ice. Here's the thing about Miracle on Ice. That's the 1980 Olympic team beating the Russians. Yeah. That was on tape delay. That wasn't live.
Well, but they remember when it was on tape delay.
I just think it's wild. Like, that was something we knew was coming when we were watching it, you know?
Sean, not necessarily, though, because you could keep yourself...
That's true.
It's 1980.
Yourself
ignorant about that
stuff, true.
You know?
Yeah.
It was a lot easier to keep yourself ignorant.
Yeah, I'm projecting.
Yeah, so you knew it was coming. A lot of people didn't, so they remember that moment when they saw it or maybe when they learned of it.
Here's a good one. When Magic Johnson, you found out Magic Johnson had the HIV virus.
And that he was definitely going to die.
Yeah,
you
right.
Know? Like, at that point, I mean, he was right there at that moment when, for the most of it, like, and I don't remember what the actual immunology was at that point, everybody, but as, like, the public at large, most of us didn't think that anybody survived AIDS.
Dude.
You know, like, so, like, that's a, whatever advances they had made, my young mind, it wasn't there yet. Like, he was going to die. It was crazy.
That was November of 1991. I was at training for my first job out of college in California.
Yeah.
So I'm in a room full of, like, neophyte salespeople. It was all college kids they hired for this company. So I'm in this room with 25 young salespeople, and we had these trainers training us who had all been, like, super successful salespeople with the company. And I remember one of them was a Lakers fan, and the day after Magic had his press conference, he came in and he had a moment of silence in the classroom for Magic Johnson at the beginning of
really?
The class.
Wow, man.
Yeah, like, that's if you're trying to illustrate, and nobody thought it was weird. Like,
right, that's right,
what,
yeah,
right? Like, that's what, like, we all felt. Like, Magic Johnson was such a pop culture touch point at that time.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was still a great basketball player at that time. And that felt normal in that class.
I think, you know, in a lot of ways, man, I mean, not to go too deep into this, obviously, but like, I would like to go kind of back and revisit, like, just exactly how maybe my perception about AIDS changed after that or whatever, mm-hmm. because in a lot of ways early on, it was painted very much in just, you know, nope, it's just these people get it. It's not like there's a, depending on like what level of bigotry or anger you had towards whatever, it just things changed a lot after Magic Johnson had it, in terms of, I think some people were more easy, like were more swayed to be sympathetic, perhaps.
Yep, maybe
whether,
so.
Obviously, that's right or wrong.
Maybe so. Mark McGwire, when he broke the home run record, that's not one for me. Obviously a huge sports moment for sure.
I'll tell you what, I remember when I learned about Andro. I was riding.
I do remember.
I was driving my car to Ithaca, I remember, and I was listening on the radio talking about this supplement they found in McGuire's locker.
Yeah, yeah. Man. Yeah. 9/11, the Boston Marathon bombing somebody sent in. The Berlin Wall coming down in the late 80s was a
big
one.
Specifically where I was when all that happened. That I remember that more as just kind of a general period of time when you'd see the images on TV and everything.
I guess for our older listeners, because I kind of ran this by a couple people who are older than me yesterday when I was kind of thinking about this. And I think for the people maybe older, like the next generation beyond you and I, Seth, it's probably like JFK and landing on the moon. Like,
oh,
in the 60s,
yeah, yeah.
Like, those are probably theirs, or on their list, you know?
The moon landing, I mean, that was one that just everybody, like, everybody universally across the country was watching it, because there were only three channels on television, and your school stopped to watch it on the big moment. Kids, used to be a really big moment back in the day if they wheeled the television into your classroom.
Oh, it was huge.
Yeah.
It was huge. Yeah, something big was going on.
It was really, really big.
Yeah.
Or once a week, they would bring in the Apple computer, and you would learn how to, like, write your name on a dot matrix printer or something. Like, that was once a week, maybe once a month. I can't remember how often the computer
was. Or program in BASIC. You know, you line up 10, type Sean is cool, 20, go to 10. And then the whole screen would just be Sean is cool, like shuffling.
That's a pretty good memory of, good job.
Thanks. Yeah,
you remember a lot of your basic computer programming.
Seth, you got to have a plan B, you know, and if this sports radio thing doesn't work out, I'm sure there's plenty of companies that are looking for somebody to come do programming in BASIC for them.
And then be able to download it onto or upload it onto a cassette tape.
Right, right.
It's like if you could have a cassette tape with a computer program on it.
That is real. That is real. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Man, the texts are rolling in. We'll get to some of these. Payne and Pendergast, you're listening.
The 9 o'clock hour will be nothing but us reminiscing events from world history.
Right, it's just reminiscing about everything.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.